9.
I do not remember what I was doing or where I was on that Sunday when I first heard the news that the American embassy had been occupied by a ragtag group of students. It is strange, but the only thing I remember was that it was sunny and mild, and the news didn't sink in until the next day when Ahmad, Khomeini's son, announced his father's support of the students and issued a defiant statement, saying if they do not give us the criminals, referring to the Shah and Bakhtiar, then we will do whatever is necessary. 2 days later, on November 6th, Prime Minister Bazargan, who was being increasingly attacked by the religious hardliners and the left as liberal and pro-Western, resigned. Soon the walls of the embassy were covered with new slogans, such as, America can't do a damn thing against us. This is not a struggle between the US and Iran. It is a struggle between Islam and blasphemy. The more we die, the stronger we will become. A tent was raised on the sidewalk and filled with propaganda against America, exposing its crimes around the world and proclaiming the necessity to export the revolution. At the university, the mood was both jubilant and apprehensive. Some of my students, Bahri and Niazi among them, had disappeared and were presumably active on the front lines of this new struggle. Tense discussions and excited whispers replaced regular classes. Both the religious and leftist organizations, especially the Mujahideen and the Marxist Fadaiyan, supported the hostage-taking. I remember one heated debate where one of the students, who was mocked as a liberal, kept saying, "What's the point of taking them hostage? Haven't we already kicked them out?" And one of my students unreasonably reasoned that no, not yet, that American influence was still everywhere. We wouldn't be free until the voice of America was shut down. By now, the American embassy was no longer known as the American embassy. It was called the Nest of Spies. When taxi drivers asked us where we wanted to go, we would mockingly say, "Please take us to the Nest of Spies." People were bussed in daily from the provinces and villages who didn't even know where America was, and sometimes thought they were actually being taken to America. They were given food and money, and they could stay and joke and picnic with their families in front of the Nest of Spies. In exchange, they were asked to demonstrate, to shout, "Death to America," and every now and then to burn the American flag. Three men sit in a semicircle talking eagerly, while a little further on, two women in black chadors with three or four small children hovering around them are making sandwiches and handing them over to the men. A festival? A picnic? An Islamic Woodstock? If you move a little closer to this small group, you can hear their conversation. Their accents indicate that they come from the province of Isfahan. One of them has heard that the Americans are becoming Muslims by the thousands, and that Jimmy Carter is really scared. "He should be scared," another one says as he bites into his sandwich. "I hear the American police are confiscating all portraits of the Imam." Truth is mixed with wild rumors, rumors of the Shah's mistreatment by his former Western allies, of the imminent Islamic revolution in America. Will America hand him over? Further down, you can hear sharper and more clipped cadences. "But this isn't democratic centralism. Religious tyranny, long-term allies, and more than any other word, liberals." Four or five students with books and pamphlets under their arms are deep in discussion. I recognize one of my leftist students who sees me, smiles, and comes towards me. "Hello, Professor. I see you've joined us." "Who is us?" I asked him. "The masses, the real people," he says quite seriously. "But this is not your demonstration," I say. "You're wrong there," he says. "We have to be present every day to keep the fire going, to prevent the liberals from striking a deal." The loudspeakers interrupt us, shouting, "Neither East nor West. We want the Islamic Republic. America can't do a damn thing. We will fight, we will die, we won't compromise." I could never accept this air of festivity, the jovial arrogance that dominated the crowds in front of the embassy. Two streets away, a completely different reality was unfolding. Sometimes it seemed to me that the government operated in its own separate universe. It created a big circus, put on a big act while people went about their business. The fact was that America, the place I knew and had lived in for so many years, had suddenly been turned into a never-never land by the Islamic Revolution. The America of my past was fast fading in my mind, overtaken by all the clamor of new definitions. That was when the myth of America started to take hold of Iran. Even those who wished its death were obsessed by it. America had become both the land of Satan and paradise lost. A sly curiosity about America had been kindled that in time would turn the hostage takers into its hostages. 10. In my diary for the year 1980, I have a small note. Gatsby from Jeff. Jeff was an American reporter from New York with whom I roamed the streets of Tehran for a few months. At the time, I didn't understand why I had become so dependent on these rambles. Some people take up alcohol during periods of stress, and I took up Jeff. I needed desperately to describe what I had witnessed to that other part of the world I had now left behind, seemingly forever. I took up writing letters to my American friends, giving minute and detailed accounts of life in Iran, but most of those letters were never sent. It was obvious that Jeff was lonely, and despite his obsessive love for his job, for which he had been greatly acknowledged, he needed to talk to someone who could speak his language and share a few memories. I discovered to my surprise that I was afflicted by the same predicament. I had just returned to my home, where I could speak at last in my mother tongue. And here I was longing to talk to someone who spoke English, preferably with a New York accent, someone who was intelligent and appreciated Gatsby and Haagen-Dazs and knew about Mike Gold's Lower East Side. I had started having nightmares and sometimes woke up screaming, mainly because I felt I would never again be able to leave the country. This was partly based on fact. Since the first two times I tried to leave, I was turned down at the airport, and once I was even escorted back to the headquarters of the Revolutionary Court. In the end, I did not leave Iran for 11 years, even after I was confident that they would give me permission. I could not perform the simple act of going to the passport office and asking for a passport. I felt impotent and paralyzed. 11. Art is no longer snobbish or cowardly. It teaches peasants to use tractors, gives lyrics to young soldiers, designs textiles for factory women's dresses, writes burlesque for factory theaters, does 100 other useful tasks. Art is useful as bread. This rather long statement, which comes from an essay by Mike Gold, called Toward Proletarian Art, was written in 1929 in the radical New Masses. The essay in his time attracted a great deal of attention and gave birth to a new term in the annals of American literature, the proletarian writer. The fact that it could be influential and taken seriously by serious authors was a sign of changing times. The Great Gatsby was published in 1925 and Tender is the Night in 1934. In between the publication of these two great novels, many things happened in the United States and Europe that made Gold influential for a while and diminished Fitzgerald's importance, making him almost irrelevant to the social and literary scene. There was the Depression, the increasing threat of fascism, and the growing influence of Soviet Marxism. Before I started teaching The Great Gatsby, we had discussed in class some short stories by Maxim Gorky and Mike Gold. Gorky was very popular at the time. Many of his stories and his novel The Mother had been translated into Persian, and he was read widely by revolutionaries, both old and young. This made Gatsby seem oddly irrelevant, a strange choice to teach at a university where almost all the students were burning with revolutionary zeal. Now, in retrospect, I see that Gatsby was the right choice. Only later did I come to realize how the values shaping that novel were the exact opposite of those of the revolution. Ironically, as time went by, it was the values inherent in Gatsby that would triumph. But at the time, we had not yet realized just how far we had betrayed our dreams. We started reading Gatsby in November, but couldn't finish it until January because of the constant interruptions. I was taking some risks in teaching such a book at such a time when certain books had been banned as morally harmful. Most revolutionary groups were in agreement with the government on the subject of individual freedoms, which they condescendingly called bourgeois and decadent. This made it easier for the new ruling elite to pass some of the most reactionary laws, going so far as to outlaw certain gestures and expression of emotions, including love. Before it established a new constitution or parliament, the new regime had annulled the marriage protection law. It banned ballet and dancing and told ballerinas they had a choice between acting or singing. Later, women were banned from singing because a woman's voice, like her hair, was sexually provocative and should be kept hidden. My choice of Gatsby was not based on the political climate of the time, but on the fact that it was a great novel. I had been asked to teach a course on 20th century fiction, and this seemed to me a reasonable principle for inclusion. And beyond that, it would give my students a glimpse of that other world that was now receding from us, lost in a clamor of denunciations. Would my students feel the same sympathy as Nick for Gatsby's fatal love for the beautiful and faithless Daisy Fay? I read and reread Gatsby with greedy wonder. I could not wait to share the book with my class. Yet I was held back by a strange feeling that I did not want to share it with anyone. My students were slightly baffled by Gatsby. The story of an idealistic guy, so much in love with this beautiful rich girl who betrays him, could not be satisfying to those for whom sacrifice was defined by words such as masses, revolution, and Islam. Passion and betrayal were for them political emotions, and love far removed from the stirrings of Jay Gatsby for Mrs. Tom Buchanan. Adultery in Tehran was one of so many other crimes, and the law dealt with it accordingly, public stoning. I told them this novel was an American classic, in many ways the quintessential American novel. There were other contenders, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn, Moby Dick, The Scarlet Letter. Some cite its subject matter, The American Dream, to justify this distinction. We in ancient countries have our past. We obsess over the past. They, the Americans, have a dream. They feel nostalgia about the promise of the future. I told them that although the novel was specifically about Gatsby and the American dream, its author wanted it to transcend its own time and place. I read to them Fitzgerald's favorite passage from Conrad's preface to The Nigger of the Narcissus. about how the artist, according to Comrade, appeals to our capacity for delight and wonder, to the sense of mystery surrounding our lives, to our sense of pity and beauty and pain, and to the subtle but invincible conviction of solidarity that knits together the loneliness of innumerable hearts to the solidarity in dreams, in joy, in sorrow, in aspirations, in illusions, in hope, in fear, which binds men to each other, which binds together all humanity, the dead to the living, and the living to the unborn. I try to explain to my students that Mike Gold and F. Scott Fitzgerald had written about the same subject, dreams, or more specifically, the American dream. What Gold had only dreamed of had been realized in this faraway country, now with an alien name, the Islamic Republic of Iran. He wrote, "The old ideals must die. Let us fling all we are into the cauldron of the revolution, for out of our death shall arise glories." Such sentences could have come out of any newspaper in Iran. The revolution Gold desired was a Marxist one, and ours was Islamic, but they had a great deal in common in that they were both ideological and totalitarian. The Islamic Republic, as it turned out, did more damage to Islam by using it as an instrument of oppression than any alien ever could have done. "Don't go chasing after the grand theme, the idea," I told my students, "as if it is separate from the story itself. The idea or ideas behind the story must come to you through the experience of the novel and not as something tacked onto it. Let's pick a scene to demonstrate this point. Please turn to page 125. You will remember Gatsby is visiting Daisy and Tom Buchanan's house for the first time. "Mr. Bahri, could you please read the few lines beginning with 'Who wants to?'" Mr. Bahri read, "Who wants to go to town?" demanded Daisy insistently. Gatsby's eyes floated toward her. "Ah," she cried, "you look so cool." Their eyes met, and they stared at each other alone in space. With an effort, she glanced down at the table. "You always look so cool," she repeated. She had told him that she loved him, and Tom Buchanan saw. He was astounded. His mouth opened a little, and he looked at Gatsby, and then back at Daisy, as if he had just recognized her as someone he knew a long time ago. On one level, Daisy is simply telling Gatsby he looks cool, and Fitzgerald is telling us that she still loves him, but he doesn't want to just say so. He wants to put us there in the room. Let's look at what he's done to give this scene the texture of a real experience. First, he creates a tension between Gatsby and Daisy, and then he complicates it with Tom's sudden insight into their relationship. This moment, suspended in mid-air, is far more effective than if Nick had simply reported that Daisy tried to tell Gatsby that she loved him. "Yes," cut in Mr. Farzan, "because he is in love with the money and not with Daisy. She's only a symbol." "No," I responded. "She is Daisy, and he is in love with her. There is money too, but that is not all. That is not even the point. Fitzgerald doesn't tell you. He takes you inside the room and recreates the sensual experience of that hot summer day so many decades ago. And we, the readers, draw our breath along with Tom as we realize what has just happened between Gatsby and Daisy." "But what use is love in this world we live in?" said a voice from the back of the room. "What kind of a world do you think is suitable for love?" I asked. Mr. Niazi's hand darted up. "We don't have time for love right now," he said. "We are committed to a higher, more sacred love." Zarin turned around and said sardonically, "Why else do you fight a revolution?" Mr. Niazi turned very red, bowed his head, and after a short pause, took up his pen and started to write furiously. In retrospect, it appears strange to me only now, as I write about it, that as I was standing there in that classroom, talking about the American dream, we could hear from outside, beneath the window, the loudspeakers broadcasting songs whose refrain was "Marg bar Amerika," death to America. "A novel is not an allegory," I said, as the period was about to come to an end. "It is a sensual experience of another world. If you don't enter that world, hold your breath with the characters, and become involved in their destiny, you won't be able to empathize, and empathy is at the heart of the novel. This is how you read a novel. You inhale the experience. So start breathing. I just want you to remember this. That's all. Class dismissed." 12. Throughout that year, between the fall of 1979 and the summer of 1980, many events happened that changed the course of the revolution and of our lives. Battles were being fought and lost. One of the most significant of these was over women's rights. From the very start, the government had waged a war against women, and the most important battles were being fought then. One day, I think it was in early November, I announced to my students, after the last straggler had drifted in, that they had cancelled class many times for their own reasons, and I, in principle, did not agree with this, but on that day, I would be forced to go against my own principles and cancel class. I told them I was going to a protest meeting to oppose the government's attempts to impose the veil on women and its curtailment of women's rights. I had missed some of the large demonstrations against the revolutionary government's policies against women, and I was determined not to miss any more. Unconsciously, I was developing two different ways of life. Publicly, I was involved in what I considered to be a defense of myself as a person. This was very different from my political activities during my student days, made in behalf of an unknown entity called the oppressed masses. This was more personal. At the same time, a more private rebellion began to manifest itself in certain tendencies, like incessant reading, or the Herzog-like passion of writing letters to friends in the States that were never sent. I felt a silent defiance that may also have shaped my public desire to defend a vague and amorphous entity I thought of as myself. From the beginning of the revolution, there had been many aborted attempts to impose the veil on women. These attempts failed because of persistent and militant resistance put up mainly by Iranian women. In many important ways, the veil had gained a symbolic significance for the regime. Its reimposition would signify the complete victory of the Islamic aspect of the revolution, which in those first years was not a foregone conclusion. The unveiling of women, mandated by Reza Shah, in 1936, had been a controversial symbol of modernization, a powerful sign of the reduction of the clergy's power. It was important for the ruling clerics to reassert that power. All this I can explain now, with the advantage of hindsight, but it was far from clear then. Mr. Bahri's body stiffened as he focused on my words. Zarin kept her usual smile, and Vida whispered to her conspiratorially. I did not pay much attention to their reactions. I was very angry, and this anger was a new feeling for me. Mr. Bahri lingered on after I dismissed the class, hovering for a while near the cluster of students who had gathered around me, but he made no attempt to come closer. I had returned my notes and books to my bag, except my Gatsby, which I held absent-mindedly in one hand. I did not want to enter a debate with Mahtab and her friends, whose Marxist organization had tacitly taken sides with the government, denouncing the protesters as deviant, divisive, and ultimately acting in the service of the imperialists. Somehow I found myself arguing not with Mr. Bahri, but with them, the ostensibly progressive ones. They claimed that there were bigger fish to fry, that the imperialists and their lackeys needed to be dealt with first. Focusing on women's rights was individualistic and bourgeois and played into their hands. What imperialists? Which lackeys? Do you mean those battered and bruised faces shown on nightly television confessing to their crimes? Do you mean the prostitutes they recently stoned to death? Or my former school principal, Mrs. Parsa, who, like the prostitutes, was accused of corruption on earth, sexual offenses, and violation of decency and morality for having been the Minister of Education, for which alleged offenses she was put in a sack and either stoned or shot to death? Are those the lackeys you're talking about? And is it in order to wipe these people out that we have to defer and not protest? I am familiar with your line of arguments, I shot back. After all, I was in the same business not so long ago. Arguing with my leftist students, I had a funny feeling that I was talking to a younger version of myself, and the gleam I saw in that familiar stranger's face frightened me. My students were more respectful, less aggressive than I had been when I argued the point. They were talking to their professor, after all, with whom they sort of sympathized, a fellow traveler who might even be saved. As I write about them in the opaque glow of hindsight, Mahtab's face slowly fades and is transformed into the image of another girl, also young, in Norman, Oklahoma. 13. At the time I lived in Oklahoma, one of our rival factions in the student movement, the most radical group within the Confederation of Iranian Students, convened a conference in Oklahoma City. I missed the conference, having gone to another meeting in Texas. When I returned, I noticed an unusual air of excitement among both our people and theirs. Apparently, one of their members, a former running champion, was suspected of being an agent of the Iranian secret police, Savak. Some zealous members had decided to extract the truth from him. They had lured him into a room at the Holiday Inn and tried to get him to confess by means of torture, including burning his fingers with a cigarette. When they had left the room and were in the parking lot, their victim managed to escape. The next day, the door flew open in the middle of the conference, admitting several FBI agents with dogs and the so-called culprit who was told to identify his assailants. One of our friends, who had previously admonished me for my anti-revolutionary clothes, her voice breaking with excitement, related to me what had happened, boasting about the power of the masses. By masses, she meant the participants in the conference who had stood aside, creating an avenue for the agents, their dogs, and the hapless culprit to walk through. As he passed by, they muttered threats in Persian. When he finally reached one of the leaders of that faction, the most popular, in fact, a short, intense-looking guy who, like many of his comrades, had dropped out of college to become a full-time revolutionary, and who usually sported a cap and coat in imitation of Lenin, he broke down and started crying and asked him in Persian why had he treated him so cruelly. The self-proclaimed Lenin of the Iranian Revolution looked at him triumphantly, daring him to spill to the FBI. He could not bring himself to expose his tormentors and left with the agents. Once more, proving the justness of the oppressed masses. The following day, there was a short report in the Oklahoma Daily. More than the report, it was the way so many students reacted that frightened me. In the coffee shops, in the student union, even in the sunny streets of Norman, whenever the political Iranian students met, they carried on heated discussions. Many quoted Comrade Stalin approvingly, spouting lines from a fashionable book, a brief history of the Bolshevik Party or some such, about the need to destroy once and for all the Trotskyites, the White Guards, the termites and poisonous rats who were bent on destroying the revolution. Sitting in the student union, drinking coffee or coke, our comrades disturbing the next table's flirtations flared up and defended the right of the masses to torture and physically eliminate their oppressors. I still remember one of them, a chubby guy with a soft, boyish face, the outlines of his round belly protruding from under his navy blue woolen sweater. He refused to sit down and, towering over our table, swinging a glass of coke precariously in one hand, he argued that there were two kinds of torture, two kinds of killing, those committed by the enemy and those by the friends of the people. It was okay to murder enemies. I could tell Mr. Bahri, now eternally bending towards me in some urgent argument, listen, be careful what you wish for. Be careful with your dreams. One day, they may just come true. I could have told him to learn from Gatsby, from the lonely, isolated Gatsby, who also tried to retrieve his past and give flesh and blood to a fancy, a dream that was never meant to be more than a dream. He was killed, left at the bottom of the swimming pool, as lonely in death as in life. I know you most probably have not read the book to the end. You have been so busy with your political activities. But let me tell you the ending anyway. You seem to be in need of knowing. Gatsby is killed. He is killed for a crime Daisy committed, running over Tom's mistress in Gatsby's yellow car. Tom fingered Gatsby to the bereaved husband who killed Gatsby as he lay floating in his swimming pool waiting for Daisy to call. Could my former comrades have predicted that one day they would be tried in a revolutionary court, tortured and killed as traitors and spies? Could they, Mr. Bahri? I can tell you with complete confidence that they could not. Not in their wildest dreams. 14. I left Mahtab and her friends, but those memories could not easily be left behind. They pursued me like mischievous beggars to the protest meeting. Two distinct and hostile groups had formed among the protesters, eyeing each other suspiciously. The first, smaller group, consisted mainly of government workers and housewives. They were there instinctively because their interests were at stake. They were clearly not used to demonstrations. They stood together in a huddle, uncertain and resentful. Then there were the intellectuals like myself, who did know a thing or two about demonstrations, and the usual hecklers shouting obscenities and brandishing slogans. Two of them took photographs of the crowd, jumping menacingly from side to side. We covered our faces and shouted back. Soon the number of vigilantes increased. They gathered in small groups and began moving towards us. The police fired a few perfunctory shots into the air while men with knives, clubs, and stones approached us. Instead of protecting the women, the police started to disperse us, pushing some with the butt of their guns and ordering the sisters to make no trouble and go home. There was a feeling of desperate anger in the air, thick with taunting jeers. The meeting continued despite the provocations. A few nights later, another protest was convened at the Polytechnic University. A huge crowd had gathered in the auditorium by the time I arrived, laughing and talking. As one of the speakers, a tall, stately woman, wearing a long, sturdy skirt, her long hair tied back behind her ears, moved towards the podium, the electricity was turned off. There were murmurs of protest, but no one moved. The speaker stood stiffly and defiantly with the text in front of her, and two people held a candle and a flashlight for her to read by. All we could see was her disembodied face and the white paper in her hands, illuminated by the light behind her. Only the cadence of her voice and that light have remained with me. We were not listening to the words. We were there to support and to bear witness to the act, to preserve the image of her flickering in the candlelight. That woman and I were destined to meet mainly at public events. The last time I saw her was in the fall of 1999 in New York, when as Iran's foremost feminist publisher, she was invited to a talk at Columbia University. After the meeting, we reminisced over coffee. I hadn't seen her since the Tehran Book Fair in 1993, when she had invited me to give a talk on the modern novel. The talk was held on the second floor of an open cafeteria in the main building of the book fair. As I spoke, I became more and more excited about my theme, and my scarf kept slipping back from my hair. The number of people in the audience grew until there was no room to sit or stand. As soon as the talk ended, this woman was summoned by security and reprimanded for my improper veil and inflammatory talk. The fact that I had spoken about works of fiction was inconsequential to them. After that, her lecture series was banned. We were smiling over these memories, sitting in a dark corner of a restaurant, secure in the busy indifference of a mild New York evening. For a moment, I felt that she had not changed at all since she had given that talk years earlier. She was still wearing a long, sturdy skirt, and her long hair was still gathered behind her ears. Only her smile had changed. It was a smile of desperation. A few months later, she was arrested with a number of prominent activists, journalists, writers, and student leaders. These arrests were part of a new wave of repression, during which over 25 publications were closed down and many dissenters arrested or jailed. Hearing the news as I sat in my office in Washington, D.C., a feeling I had not experienced for a long time came over me, a sense of utter helplessness, of inarticulate anger, tinged with vague but persistent guilt. 15. It was around this time, mid-fall, that I spoke again with Mr. Bahri. He said, "Well, Professor, they most probably deserve it. The students are very angry." We were talking about three faculty members who were being threatened with expulsion, one of whom had been singled out mainly because he was Armenian. The other was my colleague, who described himself as Little Great Gatsby. Both had been accused of using obscene language in class. A third was accused of being a CIA agent. Dr. A, who was still head of the department, had refused to accept their expulsion. Dr. A himself was rapidly falling out of favor. In the early days of the revolution, he had been put on trial by the students at Tehran University for defending a prison guard. 18 years after the event, I read about it in an homage that one of his former students, herself a well-known translator, paid him in a magazine. She described how one day she had been watching the trial of a secret police agent on television when a familiar voice, Dr. A's, attracted her attention. He had come to testify in favor of his former student, whom he believed to be a compassionate individual, a man who often helped out his less fortunate classmates. Dr. A told the Revolutionary Court, "I believe it is my duty as a human being to acquaint you with this aspect of the accused's personality." Such an action during those initial black and white days of the revolution was unheard of and very dangerous. The accused, who had been enrolled in the university's night classes, was a prison guard who had apparently been charged with beating and torturing political prisoners. It was said that mainly because of Dr. A's testimony in his favor, he got off easy, with only a 2-year jail sentence. None of my friends and acquaintances knew what happened to him later. Dr. A's student regrets in her account that she participated in his trial without voicing a protest. She goes on to conclude that Dr. A's action was a manifestation of the principles he had taught in his literature classes. She explains, "Such an act can only be accomplished by someone who is engrossed in literature, has learned that every individual has different dimensions to his personality. Those who judge must take all aspects of an individual's personality into account. It is only through literature that one can put oneself in someone else's shoes and understand the other's different and contradictory sides and refrain from becoming too ruthless. Outside the sphere of literature, only one aspect of individuals is revealed. But if you understand their different dimensions, you cannot easily murder them. If we had learned this one lesson from Dr. A, our society would have been in a much better shape today." The threats of expulsion were an extension of the purges that continued throughout that year and have never really ceased up to this day. After a meeting with Dr. A and two other colleagues about this matter, I stormed down the hall and came across Mr. Bahri. He was standing at the corner of the long corridor talking to the president of the Islamic Association of University Staff. The two were leaning towards each other in an attitude of men who are involved in deeply serious matters, matters of life and death. I called Mr. Bahri, who walked towards me with respect, gracefully dissimulating any irritation he might have felt at this disruption. I questioned him about trying the faculty members and dismissing them illegally. His expression changed into one of alarm mixed with determination. He explained that I had to understand that things had changed. "What does this mean?" I said, "that things have changed." "It means that morality is important to our students. It means that the faculty is answerable to the students." Did this make it all right then, to put a responsible and dedicated teacher like Dr. A on trial? Mr. Bahri said that he himself had not participated in that trial. "Of course, Dr. A is too Western in his attitudes," he added. "He's flirtatious and loose." "So is this our new definition of the word Western?" I shot back. "Are we now officially living in the Soviet Union or China? And should Dr. A now be tried for his flirtations?" "No," he answered, "but he should understand certain things. You cannot go and support a spy, a lackey, someone who is responsible for the deaths of so many." He went on to tell me that he thought there were far more important people than Dr. A to be tried. There were CIA spies, such as our own Professor Z, who were free to come and go as they pleased. I told him they had no proof that the gentleman in question was a CIA agent, and in any case, I doubted the CIA would be foolish enough to employ someone like him. But even those whom he called the functionaries of the old regime, regardless of their guilt, shouldn't be treated this way. I could not understand why the Islamic government had to gloat over these people's deaths, brandishing their photographs after they had been tortured and executed. Why did they show us these pictures? Why did our students every day shout slogans demanding new death sentences? Mr. Bahri did not respond at first. He stood still, his head bent, his hands linked in front of him. Then he started to speak slowly and with tense precision. "Well," he said, "they have to pay. They are on trial for their past deeds. The Iranian nation will not tolerate their crimes." "And these new crimes?" I asked, as soon as he had uttered his last word. "Should they be tolerated in silence? Everyone nowadays is an enemy of God. Former ministers and educators, prostitutes, leftist revolutionaries, they are murdered daily. What had these people done to deserve such treatment?" His face had become hard, and the shadow of obstinacy had colored his eyes. He repeated that people had to pay for their past crimes. "This is not a game," he said. "It's a revolution." I asked him if I too was on trial for my past. But he was right in a sense. We all have to pay in the end. There were no innocents in the game of life. That was for sure. We all had to pay, but not for the crimes we were accused of. There were other scores to settle. I didn't know then that I had already begun to pay, that what was happening was part of the payment. It was much later that these feelings would be clarified. 16. It was late. I had been at the library. I was spending a great deal of time there now, as it was becoming more and more difficult to find so-called imperialist novels in bookstores. I was emerging from the library with a few books under my arm when I noticed him standing by the door. His two hands were joined in front of him in an expression of reverence for me, his teacher. But in his strained grimace, I could feel his sense of power. I remember Mr. Niazi always with a white shirt, buttoned up to the neck. He never tucked it in. He was stocky and had blue eyes, very closely cropped light brown hair, and a thick pinkish neck. It seemed as if his neck were made of soft clay. It literally sat on his shirt collar. He was always very polite. "Ma'am, may I speak to you for a second?" Although we were in the middle of the semester, I had not as yet been assigned an office, so we stood in the hall and I listened. His complaint was about Gatsby. He said he was telling me this for my own good. "For my own good? What an odd expression to use." He said surely I must know how much he respected me, otherwise he would not be there talking to me. He had a complaint. Against whom? And why me? It was against Gatsby. I asked him jokingly if he had filed any official complaints against Mr. Gatsby, and I reminded him that any such action would in any case be useless as the gentleman was already dead. But he was serious. "No, Professor, not against Mr. Gatsby himself, but against the novel. The novel was immoral. It taught the youth the wrong stuff. It poisoned their minds. Surely I could see." I could not. I reminded him that Gatsby was a work of fiction and not a how-to manual. "Surely I could see," he insisted, "that these novels and their characters became our models in real life. Maybe Mr. Gatsby was all right for the Americans, but not for our revolutionary youth." For some reason, the idea that this man could be tempted to become Gatsby-like was very appealing to me. There was, for Mr. Niazi, no difference between the fiction of Fitzgerald and the facts of his own life. The Great Gatsby was representative of things American, and America was poison for us. It certainly was. We should teach Iranian students to fight against American immorality, he said. He looked earnest. He had come to me in all goodwill. Suddenly, a mischievous notion got hold of me. I suggested in these days of public prosecutions that we put Gatsby on trial. Mr. Niazi would be the prosecutor, and he should also write a paper offering his evidence. I told him that when Fitzgerald's books were published in the States, there were many who felt just as he did. They may have expressed themselves differently, but they were saying more or less the same thing. So he need not feel lonely in expressing his views. The next day, I presented this plan to the class.
We could not have a proper trial, of course,
but we could have a prosecutor, a lawyer for the defense, and a defendant. The rest of the class would be the jury. Mr. Niazi would be the prosecutor. We needed a judge, a defendant, and a defense attorney. After a great deal of argument, because no one volunteered for any of the posts, we finally persuaded one of the leftist students to be the judge. But then Mr. Niazi and his friends objected. This student was biased against the prosecution. After further deliberation, we agreed upon Mr. Farzan, a meek and studious fellow, rather pompous and fortunately shy. No one wanted to be the defense. It was emphasized that since I had chosen the book, I should defend it. I argued that in that case, I should not be the defense, but the defendant, and promised to cooperate closely with my lawyer and to talk in my own defense. Finally, Zarin, who was holding her own conference in whispers with Vida, after a few persuasive nudges, volunteered. Zarin wanted to know if I was Fitzgerald or the book itself. We decided that I would be the book. Fitzgerald may have had or lacked qualities that we could detect in the book. It was agreed that in this trial, the rest of the class could at any point interrupt the defense or the prosecution with their own comments and questions. I felt it was wrong for me to be the defendant, that this put the prosecutor in an awkward position. At any rate, it would have been more interesting if one of the students had chosen to participate, but no one wanted to speak for Gatsby. There was something so obstinately arrogant about Mr. Niazi, so inflexible, that in the end I persuaded myself I should have no fear of intimidating him. A few days later, Mr. Bahri came to see me. We had not met for what seemed like a long time. He was a little outraged. I enjoyed the fact that for the first time he seemed agitated and had forgotten to talk in his precise and leisurely manner. Was it necessary to put this book on trial, he wanted to know. I was somewhat taken aback. Did he want me to throw the book aside without so much as a word in its defense? Anyway, this is a good time for trials, I said. Is it not? 17. All through the week before the trial, whatever I did, whether talking to friends and family or preparing for classes, part of my mind was constantly occupied on shaping my arguments for the trial. This was, after all, not merely a defense of Gatsby, but of a whole way of looking at and appraising literature and reality for that matter. Bijan, who seemed quite amused by all this, told me one day that I was studying Gatsby with the same intensity as a lawyer scrutinizing a textbook on law. I turned to him and said, "You don't take this seriously, do you?" He said, "Of course I take it seriously. You have put yourself in a vulnerable position in relation to your students. You have allowed them, no, not just that, you have forced them into questioning your judgment as a teacher. So you have to win this case. This is very important for a junior member of the faculty in her first semester of teaching. But if you're asking for sympathy, you won't get it from me. You're loving it. Admit it. You love this sort of drama and anxiety. Next thing you know, you'll be trying to convince me that the whole revolution depends on this." "But it does. Don't you see?" I implored. He shrugged and said, "Don't tell me. I suggest you put your ideas to Ayatollah Khomeini. On the day of the trial, I left for school early and roamed the leafy avenues before heading to class. As I entered the Faculty of Persian and Foreign Languages and Literature, I saw Mahtab standing by the door with another girl. She wore a peculiar grin that day, like a lazy kid who has just gotten an A. She said, "Professor, I wondered if you would mind if Nasreen sits in on the class today." I looked from her to her young companion. She couldn't have been more than 13 or 14 years old. She was very pretty, despite her own best efforts to hide it. Her looks clashed with her solemn expression, which was neutral and adamantly impenetrable. Only her body seemed to express something. She kept leaning on one leg and then the other as her right hand gripped and released the thick strap of her heavy shoulder bag. Mahtab, with more animation than usual, told me that Nasreen's English was better than most college kids, and when she'd told her about Gatsby's trial, she was so curious that she'd read the whole book. I turned to Nasreen and asked, "What did you think of Gatsby?" She paused and then said quietly, "I can't tell." I said, "Do you mean you don't know or you can't tell me?" She said, "I don't know, but maybe I just can't tell you." That was the beginning of it all. After the trial, Nasreen asked permission to continue attending my classes whenever she could. Mahtab told me that Nasreen was her neighbor. She belonged to a Muslim organization, but was a very interesting kid, and Mahtab was working on her, an expression the leftists used to describe someone they were trying to recruit. I told Nasreen she could come to my class on one condition. At the end of term, she would have to write a 15-page paper on Gatsby. She paused, as she always did, as if she didn't quite have sufficient words at her command. Her responses were always reluctant and forced. One felt almost guilty for making her talk. Nasreen demurred at first, and then she said, "I'm not that good." "You don't need to be good," I said, "and I'm sure you are. After all, you're spending your free time here. I don't want a scholarly paper. I want you to write your own impressions. Tell me in your own words what Gatsby means to you." She was looking at the tip of her shoes and she muttered that she would try. From then on, every time I came to class, I would look for Nasreen, who usually followed Mahtab and sat beside her. She would be busy taking notes all through the session, and she even came a few times when Mahtab didn't show up. Then suddenly, she stopped coming until the last class, when I saw her sitting in a corner, busying herself with the notes she scribbled. Once I had agreed to accept my young intruder, I left them both and continued. I needed to stop by the department office before class to pick up a book Dr. A had left for me. When I entered the classroom that afternoon, I felt a charged silence follow me in. The room was full. Only one or two students were absent, and Mr. Bahri, whose activities or disapproval had kept him away. Zarin was laughing and swapping notes with Vida, and Mr. Niazi stood in a corner talking to two other Muslim students who repaired to their seats when they caught sight of me. Mahtab was sitting beside her new recruit, whispering to her conspiratorially. I spoke briefly about the next week's assignment and proceeded to set the trial in motion. First, I called forth Mr. Farzan, the judge, and asked him to take his seat in my usual chair behind the desk. He sauntered up to the front of the class with an ill-disguised air of self-satisfaction. A chair was placed near the judge for the witnesses. I sat beside Zarin on the left side of the room, by the large window, and Mr. Niazi sat with some of his friends on the other side, by the wall. The judge called the session to order. And so began the case of the Islamic Republic of Iran versus the Great Gatsby. Mr. Niazi was called to state his case against the defendant. Instead of standing, he moved his chair to the center of the room and started to read in a monotonous voice from his paper. The judge sat uncomfortably behind my desk and appeared to be mesmerized by Mr. Niazi. Every once in a while, he blinked rather violently. A few months ago, I was finally cleaning up my old files, and I came across Mr. Niazi's paper written in immaculate handwriting. It began with, "In the name of God," words that later became mandatory on all official letterheads and in all public talks. Mr. Niazi picked up the pages of his paper one by one, gripping rather than holding them, as if afraid that they might try to escape his hold. "Islam is the only religion in the world that has assigned a special sacred role to literature in guiding man to a godly life." He then intoned, "This becomes clear when we consider that the Quran, God's own word, is the prophet's miracle. Through the word, you can heal or you can destroy. You can guide or you can corrupt. That is why the word can belong to Satan or to God. Imam Khomeini has relegated a great task to our poets and writers," he droned on triumphantly, laying down one page and picking up another. "He has given them a sacred mission, much more exalted than that of the materialistic writers in the West. If our Imam is the shepherd who guides the flock to its pasture, then the writers are the faithful watchdogs who must lead according to the shepherd's dictates." A giggle could be heard from the back of the class. I glanced around behind me and caught Zarin and Vida whispering. Nasreen was staring intently at Mr. Niazi and absent-mindedly chewing her pencil. Mr. Farzan seemed to be preoccupied with an invisible fly and blinked exaggeratedly at intervals. When I turned my attention back to Mr. Niazi, he was saying, "Ask yourself which you would prefer, the guardianship of a sacred and holy task or the materialistic reward of money and position that has corrupted," and here he paused without taking his eyes off his paper, seeming to drag the sapless words to the surface. "That has corrupted," he repeated, "the Western writers and deprived their work of spirituality and purpose. That is why our Imam says that the pen is mightier than the sword." The whispers and titters in the back rows had become more audible. Mr. Farzan was too inept a judge to pay attention, but one of Mr. Niazi's friends cried out, "Your Honor, could you please instruct the gentlemen and ladies in the back to respect the court and the prosecutor?" "So be it," said Mr. Farzan irrelevantly. "Our poets and writers in this battle against the great Satan," Niazi continued, "play the same role as our faithful soldiers, and they will be accorded the same reward in heaven. We students, as the future guardians of culture, have a heavy task ahead of us. Today we have planted Islam's flag of victory inside the nest of spies on our own soil. Our task, as our Imam has stated, is to purge the country of the decadent Western culture and..." At this point, Zarin stood up. "Objection, Your Honor," she cried out. Mr. Farzan looked at her in some surprise. "What do you object to?" "This is supposed to be about the Great Gatsby," said Zarin. "The prosecutor has taken up 15 precious minutes of our time without saying a single word about the defendant. Where is this all going?" For a few seconds, both Mr. Farzan and Mr. Niazi looked at her in wonder. Then Mr. Niazi said, without looking at Zarin, "This is an Islamic court, not Perry Mason. I can present my case the way I want to, and I'm setting the context. I want to say that as a Muslim, I cannot accept Gatsby. Mr. Farzan, attempting to rise up to his role, said, "Well, please move on then." Zarin's interruptions had upset Mr. Niazi, who, after a short pause, lifted his head from his paper and said with some excitement, "You're right. It's not worth it." We were left to wonder what was not worth it for a few seconds until he continued, "I don't have to read from a paper, and I don't need to talk about Islam. I have enough evidence, every page, every single page," he cried out, "of this book is its own condemnation." He turned to Zarin, and one look at her indifferent expression was enough to transform him. All through this revolution, we have talked about the fact that the West is our enemy. It is the great Satan, not because of its military might, not because of its economic power, but because of, another pause, and then, because of its sinister assault on the very roots of our culture, what our Imam calls cultural aggression. This I would call a rape of our culture, Mr. Niazi stated, using a term that later became the hallmark of the Islamic Republic's critique of the West. And if you want to see cultural rape, you need to go no further than this very book. He picked his Gatsby up from beneath the pile of papers and started waving it in our direction. Zarin rose to her feet again. "Your Honor," she said, with barely disguised contempt, "these are all baseless allegations, falsehoods." Mr. Niazi did not allow his Honor to respond. He half rose from his seat and cried out, "Will you let me finish? You will get your turn. I will tell you why. I will tell you why." And then he turned to me and in a softer voice said, "Ma'am, no offense meant to you." I, who had by now begun to enjoy the game, said, "Go ahead, please, and remember, I am here in the role of the book. I will have my say in the end." "Maybe during the reign of the corrupt Pahlavi regime," Niazi continued, "adultery was the accepted norm." Zarin was not one to let go. "I object," she cried out. "There is no factual basis to this statement." "Okay," he conceded, "but the values were such that adultery went unpunished. This book preaches illicit relations between a man and woman. First, we have Tom and his mistress, the scene in her apartment. Even the narrator, Nick, is implicated. He doesn't like their lies, but he has no objection to their fornicating and sitting on each other's laps and those parties at Gatsby's. Remember, ladies and gentlemen, this Gatsby is the hero of the book. And who is he? He is a charlatan. He's an adulterer. He is a liar. This is the man Nick celebrates and feels sorry for. This man, this destroyer of homes." Mr. Niazi was clearly agitated as he conjured the fornicators, liars, and adulterers roaming freely in Fitzgerald's luminous world, immune from his wrath and from prosecution. "The only sympathetic person here is the cuckolded husband, Mr. Wilson," Mr. Niazi boomed. "When he kills Gatsby, it is the hand of God. He is the only victim. He is the genuine symbol of the oppressed in the land of the great Satan." The trouble with Mr. Niazi was that even when he became excited and did not read from his paper, his delivery was monotonous. Now he mainly shouted and cried out from his semi-stationary position. "The one good thing about this book," he said, waving the culprit in one hand, "is that it exposes the immorality and decadence of American society. But we have fought to rid ourselves of this trash. and it is high time that such books be banned. He kept calling Gatsby this Mr. Gatsby and could not bring himself to name Daisy, whom he referred to as that woman. According to Niazi, there was not a single virtuous woman in the whole novel. What kind of model are we setting for our innocent and modest sisters? He asked his captive audience, by giving them such a book to read. As he continued, he became increasingly animated, yet he refused throughout to budge from his chair. Gatsby is dishonest, he cried out, his voice now shrill. He earns his money by illegal means and tries to buy the love of a married woman. This book is supposed to be about the American dream. But what sort of a dream is this? Does the author mean to suggest that we should all be adulterers and bandits? Americans are decadent and in decline because this is their dream. They are going down. This is the last hiccup of a dead culture, he concluded triumphantly, proving that Zarin was not the only one to have watched Perry Mason. Perhaps our honorable prosecutor should not be so harsh, Vida said, once it was clear that Niazi had at last exhausted his argument. Gatsby dies, after all, so one could say that he gets his just deserts. But Mr. Niazi was not convinced. Is it just Gatsby who deserves to die, he said with evident scorn? No, the whole American society deserves the same fate. What kind of a dream is it to steal a man's wife, to preach sex, to cheat and swindle and to... And then that guy, the narrator, Nick, he claims to be moral. Mr. Niazi proceeded in this vein at some length, until he came to a sudden halt, as if he had choked on his own words. Even then, he did not budge. Somehow, it didn't occur to any of us to suggest that he return to his original seat as the trial proceeded. 18. Zarin was summoned next to defend her case. She stood up to face the class, elegant and professional in her navy blue pleated skirt and woolen jacket with gold buttons, white cuffs peering out from under its sleeves. Her hair was tied back with a ribbon in a low ponytail, and the only ornament she wore was a pair of gold earrings. She circled slowly around Mr. Niazi, every once in a while making a small sudden turn to emphasize a point. She had few notes and rarely looked at them as she addressed the class. As she spoke, she kept pacing the room, her ponytail in harmony with her movements, shifting from side to side, gently caressing the back of her neck, and each time she turned, she was confronted with Mr. Niazi, sitting hard as rock on that chair. She began with a passage I had read from one of Fitzgerald's short stories. Our dear prosecutor has committed the fallacy of getting too close to the amusement park, she said. He can no longer distinguish fiction from reality. She smiled, turning sweetly towards our prosecutor, trapped in his chair. He leaves no space, no breathing room between the two worlds. He has demonstrated his own weakness, an inability to read a novel on its own terms. All he knows is judgment, crude and simplistic exaltation of right and wrong. Mr. Niazi raised his head at these words, turning a deep red, but he said nothing. But is a novel good, continued Zarin, addressing the class, because the heroine is virtuous? Is it bad if its character strays from the moral Mr. Niazi insists on imposing not only on us, but on all fiction? Mr. Farzan suddenly leapt from his chair. Ma'am, he said, addressing me, my being a judge, does it mean I cannot say anything? Of course not, I said. after which he proceeded to deliver a long and garbled tirade about the Valley of the Ashes and the decadence of Gatsby's parties. He concluded that Fitzgerald's main failure was his inability to surpass his own greed. He wrote cheap stories for money, and he ran after the rich. "You know," he said at last, by this point exhausted by his own efforts, "Fitzgerald said that the rich are different." Mr. Niazi nodded his head in fervent agreement. "Yes," he broke in with smug self-importance, clearly pleased with the impact of his own performance, "and our revolution is opposed to the materialism preached by Mr. Fitzgerald. We do not need Western materialisms or American goods." He paused to take a breath, but he wasn't finished. "If anything, we could use their technical know-how, but we must reject their morals."